I'd like to call the Education Committee to order at 8:05. Presence, Senator Olson and Senator Stevens.
Good morning, Madam.
Myself, Betty Davis. We do have someone else joining us later. We have two bills to come before us today. The first bill that we're going to hear today, we've heard before, is Senate Bill 134. And I'm going to ask the sponsor of that bill to come forward to give his presentation, and he'll tell us about the CS.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Senator Joe Pascvan, the senator from Interior Alaska Fairbanks. And Senate Bill 134 is Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds. And Alaska should consider adopting this act for a number of reasons. One, it will make sure that the best investment practices will govern the actual investment of institutional funds. It will withdraw obsolete rules governing prudent total return expenditure and provide a modern rule of prudence consistent with the rules that will govern the investment. It will eliminate differences in investment and expenditure rules that apply to different types of nonprofit organizations. In other words, the same rules will govern under all of UPMIFA, which is the acronym for the act. It will encourage the growth of institutional funds while eliminating investment risk that threaten principal, and it will assure that there are adequate assets in any institutional fund to meet program needs, and it will be part of a uniform nationwide system. To indicate the level of support, we already have letters of support from the University of Alaska Foundation and the 4-Acre Group, and we have a letter from the Rasmussen Foundation on the way. And these organizations believe that this act will, it's basically a 21st century prudent investment act to get Alaska where I believe it should be.
Thank you. Dana, are you going to tell us the changes in the CS? Good morning. You're doing 134.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dana Owen. I'm staff to this committee. The CS you have before you, work draft backslash S, incorporates two changes that appear on page 8 in the last section of the bill, the applicability section. These are in response to suggestions by the university and the University Foundation, who noted that some of their funds don't qualify technically as endowment funds, but they still wanted to make sure that they came under the provisions of the act. So on line 21, you'll see that the last word in that line is institutional. That replaces the term endowment in the original bill. And similarly, in line 24, we use the word institution, as in this section, institution and institutional fund, rather than referring to endowment funds.
Yes. Thank you. What we need to do is adopt this CS before us.
Hey, Madam Chairman, I move that we adopt, the committee adopt CS for Senate Bill number 134, version Sierra, as a working document.
Thank you. And I'll object for discussion. We'll open for discussion. Senator Stevens.
I just want an explanation of the difference between institutional and endowment. Could we just have a quick understanding? What funds are in the university that they might be able to invest, because it's called institutional funds, not endowment funds?
Senator Stevens, the intent of replacing institutional rather than endowment was to make sure that its application was as broad as possible. When you look at on pages 6 and 7, there's a definitional section, and endowment fund has a more narrow definition than institutional fund. And so the Alaska's member with the Uniform Commission, in having sent this bill back to the Uniform National Committee, the recommendation that the National Committee made to them was to have the word institutional substituted for endowment to make it clear that its application was as broad as possible.
We also have Jim Lynch on the phone, if he wants to speak to that question.
This is Jim Tom Lynch from the University of Alaska, and Senator Pascavan is correct. The recommendation actually came from the Uniform Law Commission itself, and it's to, and what it is they're trying to ensure that what Alaska has is the same as what the other states have in place already, and that it's consistent with the uniform laws approved by the commission. The BAC actually does cover more than endowments. Endowments is just one of the funds that it covers. It covers all funds of all charitable organizations that are nonprofits. And it's really to, as Senator Prescott indicated, it's really designed for prudent investment and management of all these funds, not just endowments. That's all.
Thank you. Any further questions, Senator Stevens?
No,
anyone else? Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we look at the commission, how long has the commission been in, what's been the success rate as far as their ability to go ahead and manage funds? Do you have any idea?
As far as, like, for example, the university foundation's management of the funds, I know myself personally, I've sat on a finance board for a 501c3 organization for over 15 years. There's organizations and institutional funds that have been around for decades and decades, and I believe the impetus for the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds arose in 2001, 2002, in that market when the market collapsed and the charitable needs of these institutions remained at the levels that they were at, but the funds that were in these charitable organizations, how do you, as a volunteer on these charitable organizations, how do you, in a prudent manner, distribute funds to meet those charitable needs? So the intent of this is to try to define prudence to recognize that the charitable needs continue, but at the same time you want to have that definition of prudence, maintain the fund so that it doesn't dissipate over time, but recognizing in hard financial times that the definition of prudent may include a charitable fund dispersing monies even if you have a bad economic market. That's the intent of it. So they've been around for decades.
So what has happened to these funds that has been managed by this group during the 2001 downturn and then now this significant global recession that's happening right now?
Well, many institutional funds are underwater in the sense that they are below their initial contributed capital amount. Not all of those funds are underwater, and Mr. Lynch from the University Foundation, I believe, in his testimony last week indicated out of the, I think there were 600 or 500 plus, that 250 of them were underwater, technically underwater, but many charitable organizations are struggling right now because of the economic downturn. But the charitable needs still continue, and so the question is how does a volunteer sitting on that board in a prudent manner deal with the funds that they have available to them to meet those charitable needs? That's the intent of this bill.
One last question, Madam Chairman. I'm having a hard time tying charitable funds, which you look to give away to people that are in need, and institutional funds, which are more to go ahead and make sure that some kind of university or some learning institution can continue to function in spite of what's happening.
Yes, Senator Olson, through the chair. Specifically, the university distributes scholarships, and students continue to be educated even in down times, and in fact the demand for education increases in a down economy. And so the question is can the university foundation distribute scholarships to those students, or would the potential that it's a violation of a fiduciary rule, would you say you cannot distribute scholarships just because the market's down? This bill says that the fund, the trustees on the fund that are in a fiduciary capacity and exercising prudence can make realistic determinations, distribute scholarships even in a down market. I believe Mr. Lynch may be able to speak specifically to the scholarship aspect of it, but
That's correct. If you look at what just the purpose of an endowment is, it's essentially...
Mr. Lynch?
Would you just state your name for the record and what you represent so that they can have it for the record?
This is Jim Lynch from the University of Alaska Foundation. And the purpose of an endowment is really to support a program and in perpetuity, forever, essentially. So the question is, well, how do you do that? And it requires income to do it, but it also requires consistency. And the students are here when we're awarding scholarships to students. You know, they're not just here for one semester or one year. And you know, they're here for 4 and 5 years, maybe more. So you really have to be able to sustain these things over long periods of time. And again, the issue is, how do you do that prudently? And you can't follow extremely rigid rules to do that. Now, this is not just the university. The university is probably one of the primary ones that manages endowments. But there's a lot of organizations that are out there that have these funds for different purposes. And the question is, how do they use them? Most of them are come to these organizations through contributions. They're not formal trusts, just particularly themselves. And the objective, and the courts have basically held in the past, that it's really the donor's intent that you're trying to accomplish here. And that's what the law does, is it tries to follow donor intent as to what is an endowment for, or even a charitable fund, any fund. It's all driven by the purpose of the fund and not by rigid rules. And yet it identifies a lot of areas in here as to what prudence is and what you have to consider when you're making the decisions. And these are guidance for nonprofit boards, many of which have, you know, are run by volunteers. And it's really one of the problems you have as a nonprofit is that the liability that your board members may have for actions that you take. And then you throw them into an environment where they have no rules or guidelines to follow, really, that match the needs of the organization. So what this law does, really, is it tries to structure the law behind in a manner that's consistent with the purpose that's trying to be accomplished by these nonprofit associations. And I guess in summary, that's what it's really trying to do. It's really the best practices in today's environment, and it's really being adopted across the whole country extremely rapidly. I forget the number now, but it's like 37 states have got this thing adopted already, or adopted or bills are introduced, and that's over just a 2 to 3 year period. Forgive me, and if you have further questions, I'll try and answer those too.
Thank you. Further questions, Mr. Olson?
Mr. Lynch, so you're telling me that the scholarships will be awarded to those students even though you're digging into the corpus and not just the earnings from the endowment or the funds that are there?
Actually, as far back as 40 years ago, the concepts of the management of endowments have changed over the last 40 years. And about 40 years ago is when it really came into play, and it moved from principal and income, which doesn't fit the endowment concept very well in today's environment. It moved from that to what is the purpose of the endowment, essentially, and it's purpose and mission that drive this law, and. But that's something that happened back in the 1970s, and what this is really kind of a recodification of what happened in the 70s, of the uniform laws of the 70s, and this just modifies it, expands it, it's more specific in detail of what an organization has to do to document that they are. Following prudent procedures. It's all part of this post-Sarbanes-Oxley environment where where you're trying to document as much as you can that you are being prudent, and it's all through government and industry, to be honest with you, not just here.
Senator Pascagon, could you interpret that for me? Was that a yes or a no that you can get into the corpus? I don't care what
the answer is yes, but there is the concept of corpus is no longer exists.
The specific understanding for this law is that it's default legislation, in the sense that if there is a charitable contribution made that has expressed restrictions on it, those express restrictions are maintained. But many funds, for example, might be given so that monies can be, or food can be distributed to the needy. People will give monies generally to that fund, say, I support that organization. The question is can those monies be used to fulfill the purpose of the organization, which is to feed the hungry, to give scholarships to those that need scholarships when they need it. People are hungry whether it's good financial times or bad financial times, and this says that prudent management of that fund in good financial times and bad financial times allows for those fiduciaries that are running the fund to make the distributions that are necessary and appropriate. But if there is express legislation, for example, in the permanent fund that deals with when you can or cannot distribute, that express legislation controls. If there is an express provision in the donation that limits when one can distribute, then those express provisions of the contribution control. So this, in a more general nature, deals with funds that are given in an unrestricted basis to an organization, and it says that prudent management of the funds to those unrestricted donations can be used to meet the immediate needs of that group or charitable organization.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And the short answer to that is they said yes, but you can get into the corpus, but you figure with this legislation it will allow them to do that, and that they be prudent about it. Maybe sometime they might be able to use it, sometime they might not be able to use it. And Senator Stevens?
An issue that you had brought up, Senator Pascagon, the Alaska Permanent Fund. This in no way has any impact at all on the Alaska Permanent Fund, does it?
Yes, Senator Stevens, you are correct. It has no impact whatsoever on the Alaska Permanent Fund.
Thank you.
Further questions? It is my intent to move this bill, but I want to first see if there's anybody to testify off net. Anybody in the room? If not, I'd like to close public testimony. And this bill has been vetted, so I think we've had enough. It's going to go to finance next, and I'd like to have a motion to move it from the Education Committee.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I believe we need a motion to adopt the work draft.
We did that. Yes. I'm sorry. I didn't remove my objection. That's what it is. Okay, I remove my objection. And I thank you for the recommendation. Hearing no objection, then we will sign the papers. We'll take a brief at ease, change seating arrangements, and get ready for the next bill. We have a new bill that hasn't been heard before. There's no intent to move the bill. We just want to take the information and begin to vet this bill so we can move it at a later time. I have a staff member that's going to give the overview of the bill, 104. Hope you have it all in front of you. We'll go through the statements and then we'll adopt the new CS. There is a new CS. You want to take over, Mr. Obermeyer?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. The bill before you is Senate Bill number 105. It's an act relating to continuing the secondary public education of a homeless student, relating to the purpose of certain laws as they relate to children, relating to tuition waivers, loans, and medical insurance for a child placed in out-of-home care by the state, relating to foster care, relating to children in need of aid, and to out-of-home care transition to independent living. SB 105 is modeled somewhat after House Bill 126 with some differences. This bill incorporates some provisions of Senate Bills 27 and 28. It covers a good deal of area. It provides much-needed additional educational, medical, financial, and housing assistance to foster care or out-of-home care children and students as they transition through and out of Alaska state foster care system. An estimated 40% of the 2,000 Alaska foster care youth become homeless after being released from care. Many others wind up in poverty or are incarcerated at higher levels than their peers. Senate Bill 105 codifies and increases assistance beyond certain provisions of the Federal McKinney-Vento Act, which was reauthorized as Title 10, Part C of the No Child Left Behind Act in 2002. The McKinney-Vento Act is the primary piece of federal legislation dealing with the education of children and youth experiencing homelessness in U.S. public schools. 14 or more states have enacted foster care educational legislation modeled after some provisions of the McKinney-Vento Act, and that's partially in this bill. Children in foster care struggle academically and suffer more poverty, low self-esteem, emotional trauma, social stigma, and higher mobility than others. They are more likely to drop out of school, repeat grades, and be placed in special education. A 2004 study of Chicago public school youth found that 15-year-old students in out-of-home care were half as likely as other students to have graduated from high school 5 years later, with 55% having dropped out and 10% having been incarcerated. Only 54% of young adults who age out of care have completed high school. Youth in foster care attending public schools score 16 to 20 percentile points below youth in the general population in statewide standardized tests, and youth in foster care on average read at only a 7th grade level after completing 10th or 11th grade. This is per the Casey Family Programs. Low educational outcomes are exacerbated by the high mobility of children in foster care. Frequent school changes are associated with an increased risk of failing a grade in school and of repeated behavioral problems. By sixth grade, students who have changed schools four or more times have lost approximately 1 year of educational growth. A Casey Foundation study of 1,087 foster care alumni found that youth who had one fewer placement change per year were almost twice as likely to graduate from high school before leaving care. The Legal Center Foundation for Foster Care and Education reported that children and youth in out-of-home care experience on average one or two foster care placement changes per year, citing U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families. One-third of children in foster care stay in care for less than 5 months, and another 17% remain in care for 1 year or less. That's the end of the sponsor statement.
Now, this bill that we have, we need to adopt the new CS and take a motion at this time. And you do have it in front of you, and we'll go through the changes when we adopt it.
Yeah, I'm sure I move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill number 105-R.
Yes. And I'll object for discussion. And so we're back to the bill itself. Are there any questions from the members? Did I see your hand, Senator Huggins? Are you just holding your pen?
Well, no, I have. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes,
you're welcome.
I do have questions. On page 2, section 2, Tom, could you just talk us through free tuition?
Well, the through the chair, Senator Huggins, the tuition provision, the free tuition is a tuition waiver that is explained in the key provisions of your bill. It provides a waiver of unmet need for tuition fees and room and board and expenses at a state-supported educational institution for a person who was placed in an out-of-home care at age 16 or older and who meets specified eligibility requirements. The waiver is subject to appropriation. So what they're saying here is there must be money available in order to...
At this time, Senator Huggins, we do have a waiver in place, and I think it only accommodate 10, is it 10 students?
That's correct.
And we do have somebody from the department that could probably speak to that. At this time, that's what we'll pan 10 students only. This would open that up for more.
Right. Yeah, I'm not real familiar with the subject, okay. but I need to since we have the bill here.
You go right on. And we could also ask the department to come up and help answer the questions also.
Yeah, I see that. I heard you mention some younger ages, but there's a 29-year provision in here, too.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, and I will mention that Jean Michelle, the drafter, should be online shortly. She arrives about this time. She's been requested to dial in. It does indicate that a person who enrolls in a state-supported institution, if the person provides an adequate proof that they were in custody under the provisions of this statute, was placed in out-of-home care not less than 6 consecutive months after becoming 16, and is under 29. Yes, that is part of the provision.
Yeah, it seems like an awful broad spectrum of people to be put in. I mean, I would assume at 29 you're way outside the spectrum of any foster care experience.
Oh, you would be, because you age out at 18.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly my point. I mean, there's the long echo here that we're looking at financing.
May I speak to that? The one reason that we have that age extended, and you know, that's flexible. We could always change it to another age. But those youngsters coming out of foster care, it may take them some time before they really get themselves together enough to know that they want to go off to higher education. So we lift it up to that point. And besides that, even if they started off in school, it may take them 6, 7 years, 8 years to finish. You know, it takes regular kids nowadays, and those that's having those kinds of problems getting into it would need more time than the average student would. So that's why we set that, but it's not in stone that it has to be 29.
If I could follow up on the same issue, I don't mean to interrupt you, Senator, but before you go on another subject.
Sure.
It seems to me it makes sense to put a time limit on it by 4 or 5 years per individual. There's possible you could be involved in this from 18 through 29. That's a 9 years of someone's life, you know. You know, I understand your point that some kids do take longer, but I found my children when I said, no, 4 years is it for a bachelor's degree. I don't know that we necessarily want to include people going on for a master's or doctorate. So it seems to me that 4 or 5 years would just be a reasonable time frame for anyone.
And this is the kind of discussion that we need to have on this bill, and we're taking note of that. We'll come back with another CS. And if you really want something to be added to the bill that you have a concern about, we will address it at that time.
Thanks.
So I like the discussion, so if we could just... Senator Huggins go with his questions.
Yeah, and Madam Chairman, the other one in large.
Madam Chairman, can I, on that same point?
Sure.
Unless you're going to talk about it. I tend to agree with the chairman. I think that a lot of students that I've seen, that have, especially some of my colleagues from the villages that were having difficulty with going to boarding school, coming back, and then it takes them a number of years to kind of get themselves focused on something, and if even in their mid-20s, they seem to not be single-minded. But once they get into their 29-30 area, they know what the course is pretty well set in their mind, whether they're going to be going to the left or the right, right down the middle of the road. So I tend to like the 29-year-old the limit that you have on there, but I agree with Senator Stevens that we don't want to be subsidizing master's and PhD degree.
Oh, no, it's not for that purpose.
Kind of things.
No.
Go ahead.
You may continue, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. I am not speaking for my wife, but my wife is a principal of an alternative school. And my frustration when I see us looking at symptoms of homelessness and dropouts in school, it frustrates me because we're tweaking on the edges of a huge problem. 40% of the students in Alaska dropping out of school, highest in the nation, as I recall. And we're just dealing with little symptoms of it. And to be quite frank, I would much prefer us to invest in a process that creates an environment where we lower these numbers and not look at just, quote, an education component. I mean, as an example, on page 2, it talks about the school of origin shall provide a copy of the student's record to the student's new school within 7 days after notification of transfer. I mean, why shouldn't that be for all students? I mean, if to be quite frank, I mean, why should it just be these students? Just because they're in a foster care, and that's the sort of thing that frustrates me, because there's a lot of students, not just foster care students, that need some attention by our system, so that we do, in fact, we don't just address, we attack the dropout piece. I mean, the term that the kids use for what we're describing here, quite frankly, in many cases is couch surfing, because they just live on somebody's couch on Wednesday night and another one on Friday night, and we're talking about how to pay for them to go to school. We got to get them someplace where they have a bed and not just pay for them how they're going to go to school after they figure out which couch they're going to live on for more than 3 nights, and that's my frustration.
I'd just like to point out that that's what this bill does, and yeah, it's speaking to foster children. Sure, we want all kids to have some of the provisions that's in here, and they're probably getting it because they have a set of parents going to make sure that their records get there in time, and they don't have to be moving every other week to a new foster home and have a new school to go to, and the records can't follow them, and it might take weeks for them to get the records, and they might be moved on to another area and lose all their credit. So that's why it's taking them longer and longer to graduate. And besides that, this McKinney-Vento is a federal law. That is a federal law. We're just trying to adopt into this bill things that the feds are already saying they want to take place. And the school districts are participating in this as much as they can, but there's not enough money to provide all the provisions that's in the federal law. So that's why this bill is before, so we can address some of those issues and see what we can do to make our system better. I care about all children, but I particularly care about this group because they are the ones that's out there struggling the most.
Yeah, I, and just not to debate the subject internal to the committee, but you're right about students that in this case are homeless or foster children, but there's a much larger number, and I view federal law as the minimum. And you can always tighten up federal law. It's the minimum. And it's not just about paying for somebody's education.
It's
a system that, quite frankly, is not bent, it's broken. And that's my point.
Well taken, point well taken. Anybody else? Any other questions?
Senator Davis.
Yes.
Through the chair. The McKinney-Vento, I believe the provision that Senator Huggins referred to, the 7 days, I think it's a little broader than that. It might be 20 days under the McKinney-Vento. This is a little narrower. Anchorage School District indicates they're tracking these kids as fast as they can, and they're doing everything they can to assist both in the transportation, which is not fully covered, as requirements of McKinney-Vento, as well as the 7 day requirement or whatever it takes to get those records. In addition, I wanted to mention that while this focuses to a large extent on that trying to promote them through the college years, the university in the past has reported that the gold standard of graduation is graduating within 4 years after high school, and only 6% of the students in this state achieve that. So we are, whether they are foster kids or otherwise, we have a tremendous problem, as you point out, Senator Huggins, in the educational system for all students. So extending this through in the 20s to 29 or whatnot, there may be a way of tightening this up where we could still provide an education. But this group of children has been identified as probably the neediest in the educational system, and they always fall through the cracks because of the lack of family support, essentially.
Yes, Senator Stevens?
Just a question on the McKinney-Vento. I'm not familiar with it. I'm reading through quickly here, but can you tell me, do funds follow the McKinney-Vento Act, federal funds, to the state to implement it, or are we sort of on our own to implement that act?
Through the Chair, Senator Stevens, I'm not sure how the funds are allocated. I understand they have a certain amount of money that they will allocate to the state, and the money that is not forthcoming is expected to be provided by the school district. It tends to be a larger problem in the larger school districts. I think Anchorage School District spends over $100,000 transporting children from one part of the district to another, and maybe only part of that is covered through McKinney-Vento, I understand. So I don't know the total provisions, but the statute's in place to encourage school districts to follow minimum standards.
Thank you.
And it would be my desire to try to get someone here when we hear this bill again to go through some of those things and discuss it, because the school districts are handling this the best they can, and I know they can give their viewpoint. We do have somebody from Department of Education here, and we also have somebody from Department of Health and Social Services. Mr. Lessman, would you come forward? And I'm going to make this statement. This bill is before us. And when we have bills like this come, in particular this bill, this is a bill that should be discussed, and the staff and the committee needs to hear from these departments how they feel about these bills, how they support them or not support them, what changes need to be made. And Mr. Lessman, I want you to take the message back that when this bill comes up again, I would like to have somebody from a department to come and speak to this bill. Not just to answer a question, but to speak to the bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Lessman. I'm the Community Relations Manager for the Office of Children's Services, Department of Health and Social Services. Madam Chair, just so I deliver the right message, you would like someone from the Department of Health and Social Services?
Particularly those that deal with the foster care system and know what the problems are and the concerns. So if it's OCS staff that need to be here, there's nobody online, there's nobody here. And so what can you add to this? You said you're here to answer questions. Do you have a statement to make?
Certainly, Madam Chair. You know, the department sees great merit in this bill. It benefits those youth whose, without their choosing, whose families have become involved in the state's Child Protective Services system. There's work for the Office of Children's Services and the Child Protective System. There's work for us to do at both ends of the foster care system. You're all likely familiar that the Office of Children's Services just went through its second round of federal child and family services reviews, and we concur with our Region 10 federal partners that the areas in most need of urgent attention are the safety of children. That is, the timely initiation of investigations, the assessment of safety and risk of kids in their homes, the prevention of removing kids from their homes if it's possible to do that, keep them safely there. If not, if we must remove children, reunifying them as quickly as possible with their families, and of course getting to the home visits that are necessary for all those things. So our intent, Madam Chair and committee members, is that if we can focus on the front end work, that will have a correspondingly positive impact on the back end of the foster care system. It will reduce the number of kids that are looking at these transitional challenges as they exit the system. And we feel our resources and our focus must be directed toward the safety in the front end of the system right now.
Thank you. Are you able to speak to the question that Senator Stevens asked about the Would you restate your question again?
Just a question about on the McKinney-Vento Act, if funds follow that act, is the federal government assisting us in complying with the McKinney-Vento Act, or are we really on our own? Is it one of those unfunded mandates?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I think the best person to speak to that question is Mr. Jeans from the Department of Education.
And we'll have him come up then.
If we could before he leaves.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. In the sponsor statement, it talks about 40% of the 2,000 Alaska foster care youth have become homeless after they're released. That 40%, 800 of them. I guess I'm assuming that there are more students that are actually homeless than ever get to be in their foster care system, but help me out with that if I'm wrong.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I do not know the answer to that question. I would only be making an assumption myself.
Well, let me ask it another way. You have a file of kids that are considered for being taken as wards of the state, put in foster care. What percentage of those that you consider actually go into the foster care system? And you can check that out, but it's an important number for us. And I would ask you to extend that to, I mean, there has to be some people in your organization that have more than just an estimate or a wag that of those that are out there that probably should be considered, that you don't know what they are, just based on the statistics of single parent drug abuse, when people get into the penal system because of offenses, we discover what they really look like. I mean, that's all part of the purview of your organization. Anyway, thank you.
Senator Huggins, you're correct that there's more out there homeless other than these children, because even if you just look at the OCS system, almost all the children that come into foster care, they are in some kind of out-of-home care. That they come in out of their home, they're either going into a foster home, into a relative placement, and so yeah, that's just that one segment. But all together, there are many kids that's out there on the street. We know that. Right. People that run away from the home on a regular basis, and they have a network. So we want to have Eddie Jean to come forward so he can speak to this. And we also have Jean Michelle, a draft of the bill online.
Madam Chair, we don't have anybody from the university here, do we?
There's nobody. We didn't ask anybody from the university to come, and I don't think there's anybody online.
Just a question, Madam Chair, as we continue with this,
yes.
This has an impact on the university, a serious impact on, and I assume the university would be asked to pick up the costs of housing these students. So I'd like to hear from the university how they're going to
I don't that. Think that they're picking up the tab to house them, but we can get that back to you.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Not Senator. Gene,
might as well.
I just promoted you or demoted you.
The promotion of the House is representative.
Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. In response to Senator Stevens' question about the funding, federal funding, right now there's only $170,000 that comes in from the federal government to support the McKinney-Vento Act. It's distributed on a competitive basis, and the districts that are participating are Anchorage, Mat-Su, Juneau, and I believe the fourth one is Kenai. Superintendent Como did testify to the House version of this bill and indicated that the Anchorage School District, on top of their state grant, spends an additional $175,000 a year to transport homeless children. So we know that the federal program is not providing enough funding to cover all the costs of the transportation. Madam Chair, I do not have a fiscal note for this bill at this time. I've been working with the school districts trying to identify what the actual cost would be to support this piece of legislation. Madam Chair, I would like to point out, though, on page 2, under the definition of homeless student, the definition here expands beyond children waiting for placement in foster care to children that are in foster care. Under the McKenty-Vito Act, it only applies to children awaiting placement. So this is an expansion of the federal definition of homeless. And I just wanted to bring that to your attention. Also under the line 20, under the school of origin, I believe there needs to be some clarification that the intent of the legislation is to allow a child to remain in their school of origin for 1 year. In other words, if a child begins the school year in one school, enters into the foster care system and moves across town, they get to go to that school of origin for 1 year period. Then the intent would be they start the new school year in their new placement.
Are you saying that the language says something different here?
The language right here is open-ended, so it could be interpreted that, for example, if a child here in Juneau went to school out at Auk Bay and was placed in foster care in Douglas, that child could continue to go to Auk Bay year after year after year. So I think there needs to be some parameters put on the intent of school of origin.
Good point.
So I think the intent here is to finish out the year where they started the year.
Yes. Madam Chair,
thank you.
Mr. James, you're talking about backslash A, though, aren't you, not backslash R?
Senator Olson, you're correct. I don't have backslash R.
We need to give you a copy of the changes, and before you can get into
those changes may have already happened in backslash R.
Yeah, we can read through the changes because they have to be given anyway, and then we'll have you come back.
Madam Chair, I'll get a copy of the amendment. Thank you.
One final question, Mr. Jeans. Is the department in favor of the bill?
And it does say exactly what you said it should say, to the end of the school year.
Good.
Or if the student is attending school for a summer term.
Right, that's good.
So it's taken care of.
And through the chair, Senator Olson, the department's neutral on this bill.
Neutral. Okay.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Mr. Jeans, I'm looking at the fiscal note about the education. Well, it's not the education committee, but it's affecting the University of Alaska. So, you may be the wrong person to ask, but I know you know everything anyway, so I might as well ask you. On the University of Alaska, it says the University of Alaska annually makes available 10 foster youth tuition waiver scholarships. Mm-hmm. And how does that work? I mean, do we reimburse the university for that? Is somehow will this fund that, or is the university just accepting that as a part of their doing business? Do you have any idea?
Through the chair, Senator yes. Stevens, I do not have a clue on that one. But I'd be happy to research it for you.
I'm glad to stump you. That's
the university. The university picks up the tab on that, as far as I know, but we can get that answer back to you.
Thank you.
Yes.
And Madam Chair, as I mentioned, I am working on doing a fiscal note for this bill and getting that information from the districts.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Oz.
On that note, it's a state-supported educational institution under page 2. Why aren't private schools included as well, especially since private schools sometimes have a better success rate with keeping their students in there?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't have an answer for that.
And that may be something for the bill sponsor as opposed to somebody in the department.
Okay, and what was your question? Where is it in the bill?
On page 2, line 26, it says free tuition and fees, and we're looking at a fiscal note of $1.9 million with almost $1 million a year after, and it only talks about free tuition to those. Obviously, money is changing hands, and it only talks about students going to a state-supported educational institution, 27 and 28 lines. And then why aren't private schools that sometimes have a very good success rate with some of these divergent-type students? Why aren't they included?
Well, the university is a state university is under the state, And that's why we said that, because they're giving those scholarships. There's no private people to come forward and say they're willing to, hey, you can come to our university or you can come to our program. I'm sure if they're willing to do that, we sure would accept it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we would need to go so we can get through with this. We want to go through the changes that's in the bill. And you do have that in front of you. And the first one we've already identified that it's been changed to meet what Mr. Eddie Jean said. And would you come up and go through the rest, the changes in the bill?
Madam Chair, Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. The changes in the bill, I think one of the changes you've already identified on Section 1 extends the McKinney-Vento provisions for comparable education and transportation to school of origin for the remainder of a school year or if the student's attending school for a summer term. It removed a paragraph that related to requiring a superintendent to make a written finding that a waiver of the requirement is in the student's best academic interest, and the finding is mailed to the school board and persons in charge for the Division of Health and Social Services. I think the school districts have a way of dealing with this problem. We took it out as a restriction. There are issues that I can't address because I'm not privy to how they're handling this at this time. Changes in foster care to out of home care was made throughout the bill, in part a definitional problem that related to how they describe foster care children now, because out of home care, I think, as the Senator Davis had indicated, can include relatives and other types of placements other than in a foster care home. And for purposes of the transition to the independent living program in sections 13 through 15. There are increases. It increases the one-year extension of commitment to state custody in the best interest of the child beyond 19 from 20 to 21 in section 9. It eliminates state educational loans and deferred payments and interest for a child who was in out-of-home care and was eligible for tuition waivers to offset the person's tuition fees, room and board expenses in state-supported educational institutions. And it, in Section 17, limits the monetary stipend upon leaving foster care to not more than 1 year and shall end before the individual's 23 years of age. Those are the primary changes. And in part, these changes were made to comport with House Bill 126. This bill tends to parallel that with some changes. And I don't know if Jean Michelle's on the line, but if you have any questions, she may be available to answer specific technical questions about the language.
Jean Michelle, are you there?
Yes, I am.
I want to thank you for being there. I don't think anybody have a question at this time, but appreciate that you are there. We did go through the changes in the bill. This bill is not going to go out of the committee, so it will come back later. Thank
okay,
you very
Madam
much.
Chair, I just wanted to add with regard to the changes on okay. Version A, there was provision for a superintendent to waive the McKinney-Vento requirements. That's been deleted in the legislative appropriation language at page 2 was added.
Yes. Any other comment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Just a concern. We were talking about students that are up to the age of 29 and probably are not living in someone's home, not in foster care. Just one question. What if there were a student, say, in Mat-Su who wanted to take advantage of the free tuition at the college there? There are no dormitories, I don't think, in Mat-Su, nor are there in Kodiak or Ketchikan. So would there be assistance to help those students in acquiring apartments or living conditions? It doesn't appear as though there's not, because it only says room and board expenses at the university, yeah, which means Anchorage or Fairbanks. or Juno, I guess. So my question is can this be taken advantage of by students who are in rural
communities? Could be. It could be. And we could discuss that further.
Thank you.
Yes. Any other comments?
Yeah, question.
Senator.
Yeah.
Huggins.
Yeah, Madam Chairman. Tom, it's not clear to me what responsibility the parents or the guardians have or do not have financially.
Could I answer that?
Sure.
Most of them wouldn't have any if they were connected to the family and had some resources to pay, then we would expect them to do that. But most of these children are already isolated from their parents. They've been in the foster care system. Some depend on foster parents to continue to house them and help them get through the maze of finding a job and going to school. But many of them don't have parents.
Well, I understand many of them don't, but maybe some of them do.
And I suppose
and I don't
if
see
they
that, I don't see that provision. It doesn't have any fallback to what the responsibility of the parent or the guardian or relatives or any of that sort of thing.
Not per se in the bill, but it's something that would probably be taken under consideration. There's somebody that's going to be involved with this child, a counselor, a social worker, or somebody. So if there's a relative placement out there that's willing to pay, then we would have them pay.
Yeah, I just don't see the provision in the bill.
It's not in the bill. I don't think it is. Jean Michelle, that's not in the bill that would cover that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, this is Jean Michelle again with Legal Services. Yeah, there is a phrase on page 2 referring to unmet need, and that implies that the student has already used his or her own resources. I would like to add, and that the amount of the waiver is over and above that, but I would like to add that the loan provisions were taken out of this version as well, so there's no real mechanism to require a parent or guardian to pay tuition for a student over the age of 18. We have a Supreme Court decision, in fact, that has found that there is no parental obligation, even if these kids still haven't had their parental rights terminated, or the parents haven't had their, of these students haven't had their parental rights terminated, there's no legal obligation for any parent, whether or not they were a foster child, to pay for post-secondary education under current Alaska standards.
Thank you.
Yeah.
May continue.
Ma'am, could you point out you said unmet needs. Could you just give me the line number of that?
Yes. I'm looking at a compared version, so let me just see if I can. Page 2, under subsection, a second. Just I'm sorry, I'm working off my computer. I'm sorry, page 3, paragraph B, and I don't have the exact line number because I'm Hold on, I can find it. But it starts out, the amount of the waiver to which a person is entitled under this section.
Yes.
So line 4.
Is the amount of unmet need.
Right.
Yes.
That's it.
As determined by the commission.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Any other question? Hearing none, we're going to close out the debate. There's no one to testify, and we will adjourn at 9 o'clock.